All right, thanks. I'm getting over a cold, but I'm all right. This helps. Everybody can hear me? All right. Okay. So I'm going to tell you some work that I've been doing for the last 6 years. All right, and I'll tell you, I listen to the Magic Treehouse in the car a lot for my kids, and we learn about the magicians. The magicians in 1889, who were Pasteur and Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell and Charles Eiffel, and Pasteur's motto, they asked the kids ask him, what's his motto? Luck favors the prepared. Okay, and so this is what this talk is about, right? This is a talk, a research project that started in 2000, because in December 1999. I was sitting at home waiting for my first child to be born. And what else was I waiting for? Anyone? December 1999. What else was I waiting for? Huh? Y2K. All hell was going to break loose. The world was going to end, right? We had, you know, $500 stashed in different corners of our house. And we had water. And we had this huge bag of rice, right? And we had a stove, a wood stove. We had wood. We were all set. We had a cord of wood. Okay. All right. So, and I got a book to try to ease my comforts. And the book was called Kelvin's Problem. So, okay. But I didn't know what the book was about. It was before you could read the book online. Okay. So what I'm going to tell you about actually is a bunch of molecules, dendrimers. They're a kind of polymer molecule, and dibot copolymers later on. And I'm going to tell you about phases they make. So these are phases of matter. And then I'm going to switch gear and tell you about how you pack spheres and why people pack spheres. And then I'm going to tell you about minimal surfaces. So it's a tour through some mathematics, some classical mathematics. And then somehow I'm going to take these two ideas and put them together and go back to the experiments and explain everything to you. All right, so You can vote at the end whether I've convinced you. So let me start by showing you the molecules. Maybe this isn't going to work. Let's see. I'll just use the button. Oh, it's hung. Hold on. Uh-oh. Sorry. Is the mouse moving? No. Oh, here we go. All right. Hold on. All right, let's see if this works, okay? Otherwise, I'll reboot. So there were these molecules made by a chemist at Penn, Virgil Perchek. These are called dendritic molecules. They're polymers. And the most amazing thing about it is that he can make them, according to him. Okay, that's how chemists feel about things. And so here is this benzene ring, okay, and I learned a little chemistry. At the end of the benzene ring, you can all read that little R at the end. There's an O and an R. R stands for? What does it stand for? What? Radical. It stands for moiety. Okay, chemists say, oh, and we put some interesting moiety in here. Okay, moiety apparently means thing. If you look it up, it means thing. Okay, so we put an interesting moiety. And so he takes these benzene rings with some stuff hanging off of it, something interesting, and he takes three of them and he attaches them to a red benzene ring. Okay, and the red is only to tell you that there's a different generation. So now you have this thing that looks like a Cayley tree or whatever you want to call it, this branch thing. All right, with three arms. And then he takes these three-arm things and attaches them to a central green one. So now he has a nine-arm thing that is actually made of three arms, each of which has three arms. And he can actually go up to a fourth generation and make something which is quite ramified, right? It's like a very thick head of broccoli. And this is actually, turns out, is very hard to make. It costs $1 million to make a gram of it. because there are a lot of mistakes. But the interesting thing from a chemist's point of view, or even from a materials point of view, is that each layer can be different. This is not just chemistry by chem draw, right? Each color can be different. The outside could be waterproof, and the inside can conduct electrons. So you can have waterproof insides and outsides. And let's see if this works. Yeah, I fear I'm going to have to reboot. I tried escape. Oh, wait, escape worked. Hold on. I'm going to reboot. Otherwise, this is not going to work. Wow, that's weird that it's still up there. No, it doesn't. Hold on. Right, so those molecules, when they try to fill space, they can't, right? They are too fuzzy, and they kind of look like little cones, and that's what the next slide was going to show you. So I'll show you. So they make little cones. I could draw a picture of it for continuity. Right. So these molecules Well, that's weird. Okay. These molecules, let's see what happens if I press the button. Nothing. It's still hanging. You think that'll do it? Okay. So it draws. Somebody tell me when this turns on. I think I am. Oh, yeah, there you go. So the molecules make these shapes, and these shapes can't really lay flat like that, and they curl up, and they become little cone shapes, like so. Okay, and here are these molecules, and they become cone-shaped. Sometimes, if it's not too functionalized, if there aren't too many polymers out there, they make little wedge shapes, like so. And each generation can be chemically different. Here are the cones. There could be something that's, like I said, conducting of electrons and something else that is not conducting of electrons. Okay. And so, should I plug this in now?
Keynote.
Okay. All right, it's promising.
Catch up.
This is all being recorded. It's all going to be on the web, right? Starting. Okay. Okay. All right. So there are the dendrimers, and indeed, oh, nice. too excited. Okay. So indeed, they do exactly like I said, right? They can assemble into pizza-shaped things or cone-shaped things, and then the pizza slices can assemble into discs, and the discs can assemble then into columns, and they make these nice liquid crystalline phases in the modality where the centers are conducting electrons and the outsides are waterproof. You can now make waterproof wires, right, that are about a nanometer in scale, 5-10 nanometers in scale. But what's interesting for me is that they also form these spheres. And this is Virgil Perchek's slide. He's all quite excited by the fact that viruses do this too, right? So these are molecules that have the sort of specificity that proteins do. And so the spheres, the cones can assemble into spheres, and then the spheres assemble also. Sometimes these fuzzy ones, these very functionalized ones, will assemble into columns, but often they will make sphere phases, okay? And I'll just give a brief tour of why this is interesting. If you can control how these things are built, you can make antimicrobial proteins. So this is something people are interested in. You know your eye doesn't have white blood cells floating around on it. Either do insects or frogs. They don't have an immune system like we have. But you can go swim in the lake and you don't get very sick, right? And your eye somehow is protected. And it turns out there are proteins in your eye that actually kill bacteria. And of course it's expensive. You could of course harvest pig eyes and use that for the antimicrobial protein, but it turns out it would be better if you could make them. And dendrimers are a route to making them. The other thing you could do is you can make very narrow pores, something that's only 14 angstroms thick. Right, that would be exciting because you can have small holes if you want to. One, two, about the same, okay? You can have small holes if you want to, smaller or bigger, like so. Also, of course, you know, something I don't have to say here, can you make photonic band gap materials by making controlled three-dimensional structures? The answer is yes. Can you do it all in a test tube? Who knows, but this is one way you might try to do it. And back to the final thing I was saying before, that you can imagine having something with electron donors and acceptors down the center. You can put fluorine for the pros on the outside. Fluorine is very waterproof. And you could then have these self-growing conducting wires. So that's why it's interesting from a materials point of view. But why is it interesting to me? Okay? Because I don't do materials. I mean, I do these materials. Now I do, right? But what interested me about this? See, one of the lattices it made was a lattice I didn't learn in high school. All right? So presumably everyone here has went to high school, right? And, yes? And you took chemistry. And they said, well, there's the simple cubic lattice, the face-centered cubic lattice, and the body-centered cubic lattice. Those were the three classic cubic lattices, right? The body-centered cubic had something on each corner and something in the center. The face-centered cubic, it was like a die that if you rolled it, you always would get one. Right? Head, right? Okay. But here's this lattice that it made. All right? These spheres assembled into this lattice, which, let me try to draw it for you with my hands. All right? It's a BCC lattice. There's something floating in the middle. Body-centered cubic. And then, every face has a 2 on it. So if you rolled it, you'd always get 2. But, this 2, and this 2, and that 2, are in lines that are perpendicular to each other, mutually orthogonal, okay? This corresponds to space group 223. It's called PM3N, that symmetry, all right? And it's also called the A15 lattice. It turns out it's a Frank Casper phase, for people in the know, all right? So it's a studied lattice, but it's a very weird lattice from the point of view of growing into. Why would you get this lattice, all right? And so we decided, my postdoc and I, Prima Zerhal, to ask, can we understand why hard things with fuzzy outsides assemble? Can we make a prediction, a theory for how do you study hard things with fuzzy outsides? Okay? And dendrimers are hard things. There's all those benzene rings, and then there's all these polymers on the outside. Diblock copolymers, which I'll talk about later, are like this, and so are star polymers. So we want to model them all as a hard thing with a fuzzy outside, and then we want to know what crystals they make. And listen carefully to why this is important, or interesting, or new. See, this is what paint looks like also. You may know that paint is little particles that are, they're about a micron big, because that's the wavelength of light. And to keep them from sticking together, they have fuzz on the outside. The fuzz on the outside prevents them from sticking. Van der Waals forces would make them stick. Okay? So the fuzz on the outside keeps them from sticking. The thing that's interesting here is that the fuzz is a few nanometers and so is the hard inside. In paint, right, the paint colloid is about a micron big and the fuzz is still only a few nanometers. So it's interesting because the two length scales are now comparable. So if you want to be specific, this is not very specific, but here's the interaction you can have in your head. You have this hard core interaction when your fists come together, and then you have these polymers on the outside, right? And they enjoy entropy, right? They're fluctuating around. And as they come closer together, they have restrictions in the motions that they're allowed to make, and so their entropy goes down, right? And so there's a soft repulsion. Just having entropy. There's no energy in this system. Just entropy alone. There's the entropy that they can't overlap, and then there's the restriction in entropy from the polymers on the outside. Everyone get it? Okay, so the idea is by doing this, you actually can make a potential. The prefactor of this potential is T. Okay, there's no energy. It's all about packing and entropy. So we solved this problem, or tried to, by taking it and breaking it into two pieces. One piece is the hard core. Right, the hard core inside, and then the other part is the physics of the soft outside. All right, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you how to solve each of those problems exactly, and then I'm going to try to put them together in such a way to explain the experiment. So, are there graduate students here? Right. Yes, raise your hand. Raise your hand. Any theory graduate students? Yes. This is called an uncontrolled approximation. Okay, so where you can solve it in two limits exactly and then you try to guess how to put it together. But we have experiment to help us, right? It's uncontrolled approximation with experimental motivation. Okay, so we start with how do the disk pack? So everything I'm going to draw is 2D, but you're supposed to immediately generalize to 3D. I'll help you. So here I have two lattices made of dimes which have the same area fraction. There are 12 disks per whatever the area is. So the triangular lattice is in a different shape, but it has the same area fraction of disks. So which lattice has more entropy? How do you even ask that question? How do you start to address that question? What you do is you box each disk into its Voronoi cell or Wigner site cell, and you say, let me wiggle the disk around inside its cell, okay? Let's do that, and let's ask ourselves, in which cell does the disk get to move around more? Which cell allows more positions for the center of mass of the disk? You can say, well, what about motions of the disk that move it even closer to the other disk? Well, that's too complicated. The way I'm going to solve the issue of the disks not overlapping is I am going to lock them into their Wigner site cell. If each one is stuck in its own cell, they'll never overlap. Okay, this is called free volume theory. All right, and I'm going to blow up those Wigner site cells. Here they are. There's the square. There's the hexagon. The gray area is where the centers of the disk are allowed to be. It has the same shape as the original square. The hexagon is the same for the hexagon. And we could just measure the entropy by measuring the area of that square. In 3D, it'd be measuring the volume. And it doesn't take much to check that the area is actually smaller for the square. The triangular lattice, which has this hexagonal Voronoi cell, has more entropy. Let me tell you how you could have guessed that before you started. So if you had 12 dimes, you'd have $1.20. If you had 12 dimes and you packed them tightly together, okay, in a triangular lattice, you all know that's the best way of packing dimes. That's the tightest way of packing them. If I had another lattice here where I did it square, this original area is bigger than this original area. 12 dimes in a triangular lattice is smaller, tighter, denser than 12 dimes in a square lattice. Now I expand both lattices to the same final area fraction. Well, I had to expand the one that was smaller more to get to the same final area fraction. So there must be more room. Okay? There. So that's the whole idea of free volume theory. And free volume theory stands the test of simulation. When you simulate and do the entropy of real hard spheres, free volume theory does a remarkable job of predicting it, better than it should. All right, this is a colloquium. Anyone know who this is? Yes?
Kepler.
It's Kepler, exactly. What's he have to do with this? Kepler thought about how to pack spheres in three dimensions, right? Do you know why? Does anyone know why? Huh? No, no, no. He was funded by the military. It was cannonballs. And apparently the question was, if you have a stack of cannonballs, do you know how many you have without taking the stack apart? All right? And then he conjectured that this was the best way to stack it, and this was Kepler. Actually, the problem goes back to Harriet Watt, who then brought it to Kepler's attention. And so, going to three dimensions, we know what to do, because here we have three lattices. These are going to be the three stars. I've already mentioned them. There's the BCC lattice, the FCC lattice, and the A15 lattice. Okay? BCC is the one, and FCC are the ones you know. Now you know the A15 lattice. And all you have to ask is, what is the densest way of packing spheres? So if I imagine, and I can tell you, FCC is known to be the densest way, though that was only proven in 1999. It's not an ancient result. It's anciently known, but not an ancient result. And so we can do the same thought experiment in 3D. If you take your FCC lattice with 100 spheres and you expand it to some final volume fraction, it has to be expanded the most because it was the densest to start with. So there must be more room. Okay? Everyone get it? Yeah? Get it? All right? I learned this from Mark Wise, okay? Right? Who taught me. I say get it, and you guys say got it. Okay? All right? So we'll do that. Okay. So I told you, it's an interesting aside. Why were mathematicians in 1999 studying spheres? Right? Why were they studying spheres at all? Why the sphere packing problem? Okay? Because you can pack cubes perfectly. You could fill a train car with cubes. This room, not so much. But, you know, most rooms you could fill with cubes perfectly and there'd be very little gaps. Okay? Is there a question? No? All right. So, why were they studying spheres at all? And it turns out, you know, people like to say entropy and information theory was this great connection between entropy and information. But personally, I think that Shannon's biggest contribution to, you know, thought, pure thought, was thinking about error-correcting codes. And I'm going to tell you why error-correcting codes are the same thing as sphere packing. As an aside, that's why people still study it. So suppose that we agreed to communicate in this rather simple language of 8 words, okay? Foreshadowing is 8 words, okay? Bit, bit, bat, bab, bob, bog, dog, and dig. We'll only communicate this way. We could, of course, through coding in various, you know, dictionaries, we could actually have a complete conversation and send, you know, James Joyce across the phone line using only these words, okay? The problem is if I say bip, if I say bit, you might hear bip if it's a slightly noisy line because the words aren't that different. And then you'll do the wrong thing, okay? I don't know if you get the Sprint ads up here. You'll flower the children. You'll do something wrong, okay? You'll do the wrong thing, right, when you, if you hear bip. So Shannon said, well, why can't we detect errors? What do? We eliminate every other word. So we're only going to say bit, bat, bob, and dog. Of course, we now have a much less rich language. It's still adequate for sending information, right? But now it has this extra virtue. See, if I say bit and you hear bip, what do you say? You say what? Because that's not a word, right? And so I'll repeat myself. Okay? And so see, we can have an error detecting code. And then Shannon's next step is, well, why can't we correct the errors? And to correct the errors, what you do is you remove 2 words in between each word. And now if I say bit and you hear bip, if the line isn't too noisy, I probably said bit. And if the line is noisier still, we have to put more space between the words. Okay? Get it? Get it? Good. Well, as you know, we don't communicate this way, all right? Not grown-ups, okay? And so how do people communicate? They actually communicate through sequences of zeros and ones, okay? Flying across the ether, okay? So here are the zeros and ones. And look, here are the 8 3-bit byte words. See, here they are. They're on the corners of a cube, all right? And what does it mean that I want my words to be far enough apart that if I make an error, that you can guess which word I meant. It means that I want everything to be two bits different. I want any two words to be two bits apart, right? And so how do I solve that? I try to find the best way of packing spheres that are a certain size onto this lattice. The best way of doing it will correspond to the richest language. It'll be the most number of spheres I can use with this extra constraint of being certain distance apart. All right? And so Shannon's idea is that error correcting codes are exactly about spheres and how they pack. All right? And this is a deep connection. And so, so you can imagine the spheres being a certain size. And just an aside is, it turns out that this is dimensionally dependent. It's critically dimensionally dependent. This is, people study what the best packing is in higher dimensions than 3. And the reason is it turns out that 2, you have a less rich language by using 2 4-bit byte words than using 1 8-bit byte word. The number of combinations of 2 4-bit byte words is less than the number of 8-bit byte words that can be error corrected. There's an especially good minimum at 8, which is this, which is the root lattice of the E8 Lie algebra, and there's something good at 24, the Leech lattice, which comes up in other contexts. That's just an aside. It's colloquial. Okay? It's interesting that people still study this, and there's a reason to be interested. But going back to my problem, the hard spheres, I can turn my argument about the packing of the spheres and their entropy into an argument about, I can turn it into a free energy. Always, only by multiplying by T. I can calculate the entropy. So here's FCC and here's BCC and here's that A15 lattice. The A15 lattice is quite poor. It's, these diverge when you get to close packing, when you squash them. This is the density. So they diverge above a certain density. There are no configurations. So the entropy goes to minus infinity. Free energy diverges. And you can see that FCC is indeed the best. It's better than BCC. And A15 is really lousy. In fact, A15 is the same density as simple cubic. Right? It's not very good. So, well, this doesn't explain the A15 lattice. Right? But of course, I knew this before I started, which is why I was interested. Because the A15 lattice is not approximating everything as a spherical blob. Okay? If it's just a sphere, FCC should always win. It doesn't. Okay. So let's turn to the soft outside. Okay? So here's the soft outside. So, do you guys remember how much it costs to make a gram of this stuff? $1 million, right? And you know what? Virgil would kill you if you took it and mixed it with anything. Because he would never get it back. He only has a gram, okay? You know, let's put that in polyethylene, okay? Right? Let's see what it does to polyethylene. It'll kill you, okay? It costs $1 million. You're not going to dilute it to never be returned. So this box, which in this case has 18 of my discs or 18 of these dendrimers, this box has nothing in it except the fuzzy outsides and the hard insides. There's no solvent. It's true, he has a little toluene, but he evaporates it off before he crystallizes them. Okay? So you should think there's no solvent. There's certainly no room, other room. So here was our idea. Here's your box, and you've told me the density. So I know how many disks are in the box. I know the area of the box. And the area of the box can be divided into the area of the hard insides and the area of the hard outsides. And if the density is fixed, then you must agree the area is fixed and the area of the hard insides is fixed. Which means the area of this leftover piece is fixed. And, you know, this area is not one nice contiguous area. This is what you get. This is like a cylinder head gasket, right? And for this is like what you get after you make biscuits, okay? You roll out dough and you cut out things like this, okay? Cylinder heads and engines also have gaskets that look like this. And we say, oh, it's not really one big area. It's lots of little areas. In fact, really to me, it doesn't even look like an area. It looks like a perimeter times a thickness. All right. I'm not going to view that area as an area. I'm going to view it as a perimeter times a thickness. All right. And if you want, I'll make it the perimeter times the average thickness. And the average thickness is the area of the perimeter. So I can, all right, it's an exact equation. And I think, what was the physics of the outside? The fuzzy outsides did not like being near each other. The fuzzy outsides liked that thickness to be as big as possible. Okay? So this is not about maximizing the distance between the centers of the spheres. This is maximizing the distance between the walls of the spheres or the surfaces of the spheres. Surface of the balls, okay? So if the thickness wants to be as big as possible, I want to minimize the perimeter. Okay? And so minimizing the perimeter becomes an interesting question about minimal surfaces. And so I should say in three dimensions, what happens? In three dimensions, what's the question? You take each thing, you put it in a box in its Wigner-Seitz cell, right? The volume of the box is fixed. The volume of the box is fixed. The volume of the fuzzy outside is fixed. And I divide the volume of the fuzzy outside into an area times a thickness. The volume becomes the area of the interfaces times a thickness. And now I want the thickness to be as big as possible, so I want the area to be as small as possible. Get it? That was weak. Okay. All right. We're gonna work on it. Okay. So, who's this? Anybody?
Plateau.
Excellent. All right. Plateau. And this is a stamp, so there must be a Belgian in the room, right? Plateau is Belgian, and Plateau not only worked on soap bubbles, Plateau is the guy who discovered the persistence of vision. He is celebrated in the movie industry. There's a festival in Brussels every year to celebrate him. He invented this, the phenakistoscope. You know this, right? Everyone seen this? In the museum, right? You go to the museum, you spin it, and there's a guy doing this, right? Juggling balls. You're looking in a mirror, okay? And he invented that, all right? And so Plateau is the guy who posed the question about surfaces, all right? And making minimal surfaces. And so, for instance, here are four minimal surfaces. Minimal surface theory has had this revival, which relied heavily on computer graphics, but also relied on some interesting results, proven mainly by this guy, Bill Meeks, at Amherst. So, you know, if you take two rings and you put them in a soap bubble and you pull them apart, you don't get a cylinder, you get this catenoid. You can do it with your socks also, right? Your socks have enough tension to do that. Various, these are the newer surfaces, these are four-ended surfaces. See, there's one end, there's another end, there's another end. They have handles. This is the Costa-Hoffmann-Meeks surface. This is Shirk's first surface, which is an entirely different talk. But it's a beautiful doubly periodic minimal surface, okay? But this isn't what I want. I mean, they're pretty pictures, right? Remember, I want containers, and I want it to fill space, like a lattice. Says, oh, yeah, there are plenty of space-filling minimal surfaces. These, the Schwartz-P surface, the diamond, the Niovius, the gyroid. This is my favorite, the plumber's nightmare, right? Because I have an old house and I hate plumbers, okay? So the plumber's nightmare is something where you have a box with six holes and you just keep assembling it, okay? And with great concentration and effort, you can see that the inside is the same as the outside, okay? With great concentration, all right, you can think about the pocket that's right in the center, all right? And the pocket right in the center has six holes. Here's one of them. Right? It is exactly the same as the inside. This is something which is bicontinuous. It has an inside and outside. There's the water, there's the air, or there's the water, there's the oil. Okay? It's a good model for mayonnaise. And it has this beautiful inside-outside symmetry. Alright? This has the symmetry of the diamond lattice. This has a lattice symmetry of a gyroid and so forth. This isn't quite right either because it's bicontinuous. It's connected. If I put my spheres inside here, they're not in compartments. Okay? Everyone get that? Get it? So finally, who's this? Exactly. Here's Lord Kelvin. All right? And Lord Kelvin originally posed the right question. All right? Kelvin said, how do you break up space into equal volume cells so as to minimize the area? Minimize the surface area of the cells. All right, and this was his question. He knew that bees knew what to do for honeycombs. You guys know that this was only proven in 1999 also, that the honeycomb is the best way to do it. And I challenge you to go find a honeycomb that has an accident in it. where it's not all hexagons, where there's a pentagon. How good are the bees? Okay? See, the bees are constrained by the size of a baby bee to have a certain size, and they want to use the least amount of wax. Aren't they clever? Okay? Right? Nature's little engineers. Okay? And so Kelvin generalized the question, and he even made a conjecture. His conjecture was that this BCC lattice of orthic tetrakydecahedra is the minimum way of doing it. Okay? That if you fill space with these shapes, then, and it fills space, and this looks like, what this looks like, the, what's that thing called? The Fermi surface in an FCC crystal, right? Okay, it looks like this adorns the cover of Ashcroft and Merman, this shape. Maybe it's the back in your edition. And so here it is, and it fills space, and it's made of eight hexagons and six squares, and it certainly is a smaller area than, for instance, the FCC's rhombic dodecahedra. Okay? And it's a great story, which you can ask me afterwards, how did Kelvin figure this out? Okay? That was really an exercise in pure thought, right? But, here you go. This is 1887. Remember, the bees were right. Kepler was right. It turns out Kelvin was wrong. This was not the best way of doing it. And when I was in graduate school with your chairman, we would often sit around and talk about, wouldn't it be great to prove something about, to have some physics result that depended on Fermat's last theorem, right? You know, and then you'd get to write a second paper. If and when Fermat's last theorem were proven. Because it wasn't proven when we were in graduate school. Well, this was done in 1994, after I was in graduate school. And so I couldn't have done this problem in graduate school. We are in Phelan, two Irish foam physicists, discovered that this lattice, the A15 lattice, coincidentally, had a smaller area. Okay? And it's made of two shapes. That was the Gordian knot. Kelvin's problem does not insist that the shapes are the same. They just have to have the same volume. All right? The cells can all be different, right? Shapes, but they have to have the same volume. And so it's made out of a different kind of 14-sided object and an irregular dodecahedron. And it fills space up in this nice way. There are these columns. These are those twos that if you rolled the die, you'd always get two. And these are the corners. All right? And there it is. Okay. So, that's the good news, because now you know the answer. You know everything, right? You know what I'm going to say. The good news is that that explains why you get the A15 lattice. The bad news is that this is one of those mathematical things that it's smaller, but only 1% smaller. Okay? Is it 1%, right? How is anything going to measure a 1% difference? All right, here, I'll highlight it by drawing a picture. This is the area versus the density. Okay? Here's the area versus the density, and indeed, the sharp-eyed will see that the A15 curve in red is below the other curves, right? But it's 1%, okay? And I'll compare it to the old picture of the entropy of the spheres, right, jiggling around. And I'll tell you that this graph up here, I know the units of this graph. All right, it's KT per cell. Okay, per each of these cells. I don't know what the units are here. I don't know how to convert area to entropy. This is really units of free energy. This is just units of area. So surely I can multiply this number, this graph, by some huge number, right, and get the A15 to win. All right? And you'll say, well, that's not really much of a trick. Okay? All right? I mean, I have to multiply it by a big number. I can tell you I don't have to multiply it by 10 to the 120th, or any big number like that, okay? But I have to multiply it by some number, but I'm not going to tell you the answer in that number. I'm going to give you the answer in different units, and it'll convince you, all right? You see, there's one center of mass. There are 162 polymers on the outside, all who are losing entropy. 162 polymers all get a 1% entropy gain by choosing the A15 lattice instead of the BCC lattice. And they are only having to fight against one degree of freedom, one center of mass. That's what soft physics is about. Soft physics is about many degrees of freedom that can act cooperatively. Okay? They are small effects that act cooperatively because there are so many degrees of freedom. Okay? And so here's a dumb model for the brush. It's just saying that the energy goes like the density. Doesn't matter really. we found in this simple model that all you needed is one Boltzmann of entropy. One half Boltzmann. Is that me? Half a Boltzmann of entropy per chain. And the BCC lattice was already favored. And if you had 1.5 Boltzmanns, that's 1 3-dimensional degree of freedom per chain, then the A15 lattice was satisfied. Okay, so that was great. Now, that was after the fact, so could have been an accident, right? Okay, we don't know. So we switched to a different system, right? And we switched to a different system. This is where I'm gonna tell you about this system, which is dye-block copolymers. So dye-block copolymers, for people who know about cells, these are like amphiphiles. These are two polymers, a blue one and a red one, that are attached chemically, but they don't dissolve in each other. They're immiscible. Right? And so they dislike each other. It's like you and your college roommate or something, okay? And so here you are, and you hate each other, but you are stuck to be together, okay? So what do? You segregate, okay? You surround yourself with your red friends, okay? And then they have no choice but to have the blue friends out on the outside, okay? And then, you know, if there's more of you, then you're on the outside. If there's just a few of you, you're on the inside, okay? And dye blocks are really a beautiful system because only by changing the relative length of the blue and the red chain, you can go from having spheres, this would be a little small amount of red in a big sea of blue, to having columns, to having actually a network of tubes, to having layers. This is when the red and the blue are equally long. And then it goes back around and has inverse phases where the blue's on the inside and the red's on the outside. So just by tuning one parameter, you get all these different topologies. You get spheres, you get columns, you get layers, you get these networks. So that's cool. So we decided to study the sphere phases. And there were three good reasons to study the sphere phases, right? The first good reason was dye-block copolymers cost a penny to make a pound of them, all right? And so we didn't have to worry about some chemist saying, I will not do this, okay? And you can't do experiments on it, all right? The second is that because the polymers are long in these systems, there's actually a gold standard numerical technique that is exact. It's numerically exact. There's a mean field theory. So fluctuations are quite small because the polymer chains are so long. And there's a nice mean field theory, self-consistent mean field theory, which you can implement numerically to check any idea you have. Thirdly, nobody has studied this, so we decided we would. And so we start with your sphere, okay? And what's great about a sphere, okay? The sphere minimizes the area, right? The interfacial area between these two polymers that dislike each other is minimized, and the outside is uniformly stretched. All the blue chains on the outside are stretched the same amount, and the chains act like springs, okay? You've all taken statistical mechanics. You know, there's that problem about you have a chain from this wall to that wall. There's so many left steps and so many right steps, okay? And L plus R is the length of the chain, and L minus R is the distance between the walls, and you show that it looks just like a spring as you stretch it, right? It's in statistical mechanics books, so they're just springs. And when you take these spheres and you start packing them into lattices, you now have to distort them. And you see how unhappy this guy is? This guy's unhappy. Because even though I have a round interface, which does minimize the interface between blue and red, I have now stretched some of the blue more. The blue is stretched more into the corner than it is to the faces, which means it's pulling on that round interface. Okay, there's springs, so I'm pulling in a funny way. So this is not happy because it's minimized the interfacial energy, but the stretchy energy's off. I could lower the stretchy energy by shaking the inside shape to be more like a hexagon. So here are the two limits. Okay, here's a limit where I have a small amount of red. There's a very small area, so there's a very high curvature. That means that there's a large restoring force. You have a little circle. Alright, the circle minimizes the interfacial area. The outside is unhappy because the stretching's uneven. Alternatively, I can go to this other limit where the inside is big. There's lots of inside. The walls are all stretched the same amount. Right? So now there's nice tension balance on the outside, but now I've increased the interface between the red and the blue. Okay? So you see here the two opposing limits. We decided to study this limit. Okay? Because this is the limit everybody studied. So we were going to go over here. And we said, well, there's two terms of the energy now. All right? And I know that polymer physics, you know, polymer physics is not commonly studied, but the polymers are just springs. And the interfacial area is the only energy interaction. So, here's the interfacial area, the interfacial energy. It's the area per unit volume. I've decided to write the area in terms of this dimensionless number, A tilde, which is the ratio of the area of the hexagon to the area of the sphere of the same radius. And so when I'm done, the interfacial energy is A tilde over R, the size. And let's see if you guys are following this. Which lattice, or is it what lattice? Is it what lattice or which lattice? There's only so many lattices. Which lattice has the smallest value of A tilde? Which lattice, what? No, A tilde. Which has the smallest area? Yes, you're saying it. I hear you. A15, right? It was the lattice that was the smallest area. Okay. So, it has the smallest area. It's only a 1% difference, but it's smaller, okay? All right? Then, there's this other interesting thing, the stretching energy, okay? And the stretching energy is also easy. You say, okay, in any solid angle, R cubed d omega, I have a stretching energy, R squared. I just have spring inside there. So all I need to do is integrate R to the fifth d omega, and I divide by the volume. And that, too, gives me some dimensionless number times R squared, right? Just by dimensional analysis. That dimensionless number is the ratio of this moment, if you like, it's the fifth moment, or the second moment of this shape, divided by the second moment for a sphere. And you say, okay, very good, you've reduced it to this number. But the great thing is, and here's that going back to Pasteur, when we read about sphere packing, we discovered that there's lots of sphere packing problems, or there's lots of lattice problems. So there's the one I told you about, the packing problem, right? This is making the biggest sphere that you can, that is to say, having the highest density. There's the covering problem. The covering problem is what the cell phone companies want to do. They want to make sure that everybody's in at least one cell. All right, so they want to, but they don't want to have too many towers. So they want to make sure that you want to minimize the circumradius of that cell. And then there's this, the quantizing problem, minimizing the second moment. This is exactly what we did. Mathematicians or computer scientists want to know the answer to this. What lattice is best? You know why? Because it's how you convert analog numbers to digital numbers. Right? Suppose I tell you I'm going to pick every number between minus a half and a half I'll call zero. Well, the mean square error will be a 12th if you do that. If you integrate x squared from minus a half to a half, it's a 12th. Okay? Now, suppose I give you two numbers. Should I make a square grid? Right? So I'm going to convert two analog numbers to two digital numbers. Should I make a square grid? Square grid, I'll get a 12th in each dimension. But if I use a triangular lattice, I will get less than a 12th in each dimension. So it's actually better to convert two analog numbers to two digital numbers all at once than to do them in sequence. Of course, you have to compute more. Turns out this gets better and better in higher dimensions. And they want to find which lattice minimizes this so that you can minimize the mean square error. Okay? And that's exactly the number we wanted. So the great thing was we didn't have to calculate it. Okay? And it was calculated precisely, all right, by, you know, mathematicians at AT&T Bell Laboratories, okay? They calculated it. These numbers are not actually 787. This is the square root of 37 times pi. I mean, they just calculated it. Okay? And in fact, the FCC and A15 are precisely the same, not just approximately the same. And you notice that the BCC lattice is better at this. The BCC lattice minimizes the stretching. Okay? And you say, uh-oh. No, I say, that's great. That's interesting. It's interesting that one lattice minimizes the area and a different lattice minimizes the stretching. Just like in the other problem, one lattice minimized the area and another minimized the density or maximized the density. So, I had a very simple free energy. I had a number divided by R and a number times R squared. I minimize over R and I find out which phase has the lowest free energy. And it turns out the A15 does by a tenth of a percent. Okay? Now, if you're an aficionado of Diblock copolymers, it turns out the Diblock copolymer phases differ by tenths of percents when you do numerics. So that's not so frightening. My student, Greg Grayson, here's that phase diagram. I had a picture before, but now it's a phase diagram. This is how much the polymers hate each other. This is the relative length of red and blue. Here are the layers. Here are these connected tubes. Here's the hexagonal phase of tubes. Here is the BCC lattice of spheres. What Greg did is he said, well, is the A15 better? And he discovered that along this dashed line, the A15 is better than FCC, and along the dotted line, A15 is the best of the sphere phases. This is using this numerical technique that's numerically exact. In other words, you write exact equations down and then you solve them numerically. And the problem is that real systems will not do this. Real systems, instead of making spheres, will make columns. So this was a triumph of the mind, but not much of a triumph because you wouldn't see it. But then Greg had this great idea. He said, oh, but dendrimers do it. So he made the numerical exact equations for what happens when you have a red one branching into two blue ones. And when you do that, you discover a stable A15 region in all three. Okay? And good for him, I guess, is that a few months later, somebody made these polymers with the branches, and they found this A15 lattice. As promised, okay? So they made something which was branched in this way, and it actually generates this A15 lattice. So you take a molecule like this, a long polymer molecule like this, you throw it in a test tube, you wait a little bit, and you get this lattice. Right? So it's amazing. A very complicated lattice. So to summarize, right, because I'm out of time and I'm at the end too, right, is we talked about this frustration. I call it frustration, all right? It's not frustration in the usual sense. It's a geometric frustration. In two dimensions, the lattice that maximizes the free volume is the same as the lattice that minimizes the perimeter, and the same as the lattice that minimizes the stretching in two dimensions. Triangular lattice does everything. In three dimensions, it's not true anymore. In three dimensions, each lattice has its own special gift. Okay? And the great thing is, why do you get so many interesting phases in 3D? Right? You don't get so many interesting phases in 2D. Usually you get triangular lattices. Okay? But in 3D, you get this whole variety of phases. The same materials can have different lattices, right? Iron has all these different lattices. And part of the reason is the lattices are different and good at different things. And so I told you about the dendrimers that are trading off between FCC and A15 and the diblocks that are trading off between A15 and BCC. Maybe there's something in here where you can have diblocks in a solvent, right, which the chemist would let you do. So let me end by telling you what we did, all right? I told you what I was going to do, now I'm going to tell you what we did. So we got a chemist. Chemist told us about what he made, all right? We didn't do that part. We read books about minimal surfaces. We read the current literature, all right? And fortunately, all the numbers we needed were calculated by the mathematicians, right? And we multiplied everything by T. That was our our contribution. But when you're all done, you can design crystals, okay? And, you can say, when you see a branch, take it. That's how you can get these more ordered phases or these more interesting phases. And the obligatory, there's Greg, who did most of the work on this. And, I thank you for your attention. Yeah, but you can convert the Hamming distance. If they're different by two, then they're at least root three apart.
So the optimization problem actually comes out the same.
Exactly. It's true. I would say that was Shannon's insight, is that what looks like a flat problem of making the hamming distances be at least two can be converted into a geometric problem by thinking of the bits, the sequence of bits, as points on a cube, on a hypercube. But yes, that's you're right. Really, all you're doing is keeping the hamming distance two.
You had the final slide in there. You had A15 on the top and FCC and BCC on the other side.
Yes.
Right. So in the dialogue case, you also had another phase that you talked about, the big gyroid phase.
Yes. So, it is. So the gyroid phase is actually based on one of those surfaces I showed you earlier, the gyroid. It's a set of tubes that interlock in this complicated way. And so I told you there's this gold standard numerical self-consistent scheme. It's a black box. The gyroid is the stable phase. It's confirmed experimentally. To my satisfaction, not just me. Nobody has an explanation for why you get the gyroid, right? Although it's tantalizing that it's based on a minimal surface, so there might be a surface argument, but no one quite has figured out a way of putting that together. So that remains a mystery. Yeah.
Then getting back to another question that you wanted us to ask.
Yes.
Kelvin.
Yes.
How did he formulate the problem?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is great. Okay, but this takes you... Okay, so the question... I did want you to ask that. Thank you. Okay, so the question is, where did he come up with that shape? Okay? And this... So I read it in his book, The Baltimore Lectures, delivered in 1893. And at the University of Pennsylvania, we have a rare books room where you have to take off your belt. You have to take off anything sharp. You can only have a pencil, all right? The books have to be laid down on foam that's laying on the finest smoked salmon. It has everything. But the Baltimore lectures, which are over 100 years old, are sitting decaying in my office. I got them from I just requested them from the stacks. It sits in my office. Every time I take it out, pieces of it crumble out. They don't care about that. So, okay, it's in there. So, has anyone ever taken a wire cube, and dipped it in soap? Yeah? And when you do that, you get a funny thing. You don't get a little cube inside. You get a square. You get a square, and the square, maybe I can draw it. I probably can't, okay? But you get a square that sits in the center. And the square sits in the center. It breaks the symmetry. There could be three different ways of doing it, but it chooses one. And this square sits in the center and makes a trapezoid. It's connected to these edges by four trapezoids. Okay, here's one trapezoid. Okay? Kelvin said, okay, take one of these cubes, take six of them, and assemble them into the outside of a cube where the squares are, this square is like this, and this one's like this, and these are like this, and these are like this. He said, oh, and those trapezoids assemble themselves into hexagons. And if I took away this piece of wire, it should still be stable. So that must be a minimal area way of doing it. All right? It's just brilliant, right? He didn't have Mathematica. He didn't have any programs, right? He just realized this is how it had to be. It also satisfies Plateau's rules. Plateau's rules are that whenever vertices come together, they have to has to be four vertices, and every edge has to have three faces. But, you know, this was like a vision of making this shape. And it obviously fills space because you can keep repeating this. No, I think it's amazing also.
Because no real foam, macroscopic foam, don't have that.
I know, but surprisingly, Dybox find I kid you not when I say that the energy difference even between the columns and the spheres are very small. Yet people can use the columns, you get columns, to do lithography for electronics. They can make huge sheets where you have virtually perfect long-range order. And not by doing anything weird, not by... Sure, but if the defects, the issue is if one polymer's off, that doesn't mess up the lattice. Right. Yes, that's right.
I'm supposed to leave the other questions for private asking, so join me in thanking the speaker again.